Great.
Okay.
For those watching and following, I'm Carlos Watson. I'm the editor of Positive, a part of the GSP family in many ways. I'm really pleased to be hosting yet another one of the terrific webinars that Deborah Quazzo and Mike Moe and others have put together. Today is a conversation about Black Lives Matter and white allies and how we move from here in a very kind of tangible and valuable way. We're hoping it'll be a little bit of not only a discussion, but maybe even a little bit of a brainstorm as well. I think everybody comes to this conversation with kind of good thoughts and good ideas here. So I'm hoping to try and get some participation, not only from our four terrific panelists, but also from you in the virtual audience as well. And so why don't I get started right away with a couple of introductions. And I'm joined today by Penny Pritzker and Arnie Duncan. So a lot of good Chicago love all in one place, which is good. Carol Quillen down in North Carolina, and Chip Posick out in the DC, Maryland area. So thank you, each of you, for coming. Carol, I'm going to start with you. And as you and I talk about this weekend, the way I love to start these conversations is by asking each person how they came to be in this conversation. And it's my creative way of asking for a little bit of a bio, but a little bit of a bio as it ties to the conversation we have in front of us today. So, Carol, do you mind if I ask you to kick off and introduce yourself a little bit and talk about how you came to this conversation? And then Penny, I'd love to hear from you.
Sure. Can you hear me, just to make sure everybody can hear me? Maybe, okay, yeah. So my name is Carol Quillen, and Carlos asked me how I came to this, and I was born in New York, but I really grew up in a very small town in Delaware, a town which was, while I was growing up, residentially extremely segregated. And I went to a Quaker school for 14 years, because I failed kindergarten. But it was the tension between my lived experience of, you know, what I would call it, you know, extraordinarily de facto segregated, right? It was a segregated town, and an abstract commitment to racial justice that came from my from the Quakerism of the school that I attended, and trying to figure out how one could translate these abstract commitments into daily practice. And when I fast forward to grad school during the 80s and the anti-apartheid movement, it became clear that those abstract principles that as an academic we all studied and wrote about and theorized about meant very little unless one found ways of putting them into one's daily practice, how one lived one's life every single day. And I think that's the reason why, that's the experience that led me to believe in acting in solidarity and trying to understand what it means to be an ally or a conspirator or whatever one's word is. In college, I saw the ways in which abstract convictions and daily practice came into conflict. I was in college when Harold Washington ran for mayor and saw a hardcore Democratic Party shift its allegiance on a dime as a result of the fact that their candidate happened to be a Black man. And I think that, again, the tension between stated principles and lived experience struck me. And what good are those principles if we can't find ways of living them out every day?
And Carol, if you were to carry the story forward just a little bit, only because I didn't do a good enough job of introducing you, if you would pull it forward to where you are today, that would be great, just to give folks who coming to the Davidson story a little bit of context.
Sure. So I am. It's a gift that I am able to serve as president of Davidson College, which is a liberal arts college located outside of Charlotte, North Carolina, a historically and predominantly white institution that was that excluded people of color and women, and especially Black people, from the educational opportunities of the college for a long time. And so we ask ourselves every day, what does it mean not only to dismantle systemic racism and undo white supremacy, but to create and open the doors for people of color and Black people to create a genuinely inclusive environment at what historically was an exclusively white institution. And so that's, again, daily work on our campus. And we have a lot of work to do. And my students are constantly reminding me of all the things that aren't done and how far we have to go, and they're right. And so how do we create that kind of environment at a place that is genuinely committed to doing it every day?
Carol, thank you. Penny, do you mind if I ask you to go next? Kind of similarly, introduce yourself, but in the process, maybe how you came to be in this conversation.
Sure. Well, first of all, thanks for having me. Thank you, Deborah, and thank you, Carlos, and it's great to be here. I come to this conversation with a lot of humility and a real recognition that in my roles, we're a real work in progress. And so I bring that attitude to where we're at today. My experience has been, and where I am today is, I'm a business person by background. I've led a number of businesses in both real estate, financial services, information technology. So I have a broad background and experience in my work life in business. In my philanthropic life, my husband and I have a foundation that's primarily focused in Chicago economic development and workforce development and education. And so we've worked in our communities, and particularly, right, we're very focused on the south and west side of Chicago, where we have lots of challenges in terms of racial inequity, opportunity inequity, a lack of investment, etc. And there's others on this phone, particularly Arnie, who live those experiences day in and day out. We're doing it from a philanthropic standpoint. I can talk more about that. But I come to the table, as I said, with really a business and philanthropic background. I did have the pleasure and the privilege of working to elect Barack Obama. I was his finance chair, and I think one of the first half a dozen people on his campaign when he ran for president, and then served as Secretary of Commerce during the second term. So I also got to experience a commitment that the former president made around diversity in his own cabinet, and one that he and I have talked a lot about, where he really, during the second term, prioritized that. And running, if you think of a cabinet position, as you're running a division of the federal government, how to execute those that vision, and how to live that vision, and how to actually be intentional about bringing that about is something that I had exposure to. And I'll just close that by saying, I guess two things I would add. I'm also right now leading the Illinois COVID-19 Relief Fund for the state. And we're dealing with the reality of the problems in our healthcare system, but also just the disproportionate impact that is having this virus is having on our Black and Latinx communities and our undocumented communities. So I come to the table with a lot of different touch points, a lot of different perspectives, and just a real awareness of the challenges that we have ahead of us.
And Penny, sorry, just to round this out a little bit, you grew up primarily in Chicago, or where have you been lucky enough to live?
Interesting question. My parents were born in Chicago. I was born in Chicago, but at 6 months old, my parents moved to California. So I grew up in the Bay Area. Until I went to college back on the East Coast. I went back to graduate school, and I moved in 1985 back to Chicago, and that has been home for me for now 35 years. So Chicago, is our home, and I'm fortunate enough, my husband and I, that both of our children, who are 27 and 29, have decided to get married and settle in Chicago. So we are very committed to our city and our state.
You did something right. Two for two is not bad. That's pretty good. That's definitely pretty good. Chip, can I ask you to go next? And do you mind similarly introducing yourself and giving people a sense of your journey to this conversation?
Sure. Thanks, Carlos. So it's great to be here with everyone. So I'm co-founder and CEO of 2U. So I guess I'm the startup or corporate voice here. I started the company with a small team about 12 years ago. And, you know, the company's grown quite a bit over the years. So we've got about 4,000 full-time employees, 7,000 employees total all over the world, not just here in the States. We have nearly 1,000 people in Cape Town, South Africa. I first-generation college graduate, grew up in the South Florida area, got a Pell Grant to attend George Washington University. And, you know, one of the, you know, joys of my life is what higher ed gave me as a person. So, you know, had been out of Florida twice, had never seen snow, got to D.C. Next thing you know, there's this kid from Florida, two blocks from the White House. It just completely changed my life in every way. And so one of the reasons I'm proud of what our company does is, you know, allowing people access to great high quality education, still the single best path to social mobility on the planet. I would say this past month, 2U wise, has been just stunning. You know, we have a very actually quite diverse company. What I would say is, you know, an eruption of activity internally and, you know, has taken us on a journey as a company coming from what I would say to you is a very good place. You know, we have one of the most diverse boards on the NASDAQ. We have four people of color, you know, two black women, including Valerie Jarrett, who served with both of you in the Obama White House. And I would say it's been a journey of learning how much more we have to do. So the analogy I would give you that came from one of our employees to me was how to go from sort of, you know, a theoretically good place to an anti-racist posture. Somebody told me that, you know, if you're on a moving walkway in the airport, you know, the racists are running on the walkway. And if you just stand pat, you're going to get to the same place as a white male running the company. If you don't actually turn around and start running in the opposite direction, you're not going to be able to stem the tide and sort of achieve what you want to achieve. So I would say it's just been an extraordinary 30 days running, you know, a company, not because we're publicly traded, but because we have an incredibly diverse workforce that has been super passionate about wanting to really not just improve what we do as a company internally and become a model, but to actually really sort of change the dialogue, even using our product to drive the world to a better place. So happy to talk about that more, but it's, you know, exciting to be here and be in that dialogue.
Great, and thank you, and welcome as well. And Arnie, do you mind if I ask you to bring us home? Do you mind for those who may know some of your story but not all? Do you mind letting people know how you came to the table?
If you can ask anything you want. I'm sort of less interested in saying that. Happy to answer any questions, but just honestly, kind of these conversations with a lot of trepidation and. I think, you know, I'll speak for myself, there's never been a time where I've felt more inadequate. There's never been a time when I felt that whatever work we've done, it's wildly not close to where it needs to be. It's not a time of just working a little bit harder, doing whatever. We got to do some things radically different. And my friend Betsy Hodges, the mayor of Minneapolis, wrote a really interesting piece recently about sort of the white liberal, what the white liberal has done to actually perpetuate this stuff. And I think it's really a time for all of us to self-reflect about, you know, whether it's how we fund schools or who we allow to live in our blocks and our neighborhoods to who we, you know, how do we create wealth in the minority community, who we trust to, you know, invest our money to be our lawyer, to do our technology, to do our HR, to do, you know, we just, I'll keep it personal. I just think I have not done close to enough, and we just have whatever we've tried to do, we got to do a heck of a lot better than we've ever done.
Arnie, I appreciate that. Let me ask two questions off the back of that. One is, as you reflect on what you wish you had done, what are two or three of the things with the benefit of hindsight you wish you had done? And number two, why do you think you didn't do them? And I ask that, I ask both questions, not as much looking back, but really looking back so that we can look forward and try and see if there are things we can learn in either place that may inform what we do over the next year or 10 years.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. Right now I'm really, really focused on trying to reduce gun violence on the south and west sides of Chicago. That the overwhelming majority of those shooting and being shot are, not surprisingly, young Black men. I do this work because when I ran the Chicago Public Schools for 7.5 years, on my watch, we had a child killed on average every 2 weeks. And I know we as leaders, myself, right at the top of the list, failed to keep our kids safe. When our family moved to DC, I very naively thought things couldn't get worse and things got a lot worse. So for me coming home to Chicago, this was the issue to work on. We saw 3 consecutive years of double digit reductions in violence, and that was huge. But this has been a really, really tough year. And the time post George Floyd's murder has been the probably the toughest, I've lost track of the weeks now, whatever, 6, 7, 8 weeks, toughest time in my life. I've had a staff member killed. I've had a couple of the young men I work with killed. I've had a young girl, high school student, who shot through the arm and almost bled out because no police came, no ambulance. Most recently, we had the 20-month-old son of one of our young men killed in the backseat of his car on the way to the laundromat with his mother. So there's never been a time when I'm just beyond acutely aware of how much further we have to go.
Arnie, when you look at all of this, do you, and I realize this could come across as a generic question, but I don't mean it to be, optimistic, not optimistic? Where is your spirit, 6 to 8 weeks post what happened to George Floyd?
Well, I'll go micro because I'm sort of obsessed on the micro, and then I'll go macro. On the micro, we have 2 metrics, homicides and shootings. As a city, we are up 38% this year, which is absolutely the wrong direction. But in the neighborhood where we've gone the deepest, where we've worked the longest for 4 years on the south side, Rose and Pullman, where we have life coaches and, a clinical team, an educational team, and we're down 38%. So the contrast between where the city is and where we're doing the deepest work actually gives me great, great hope of if we can scale that and do more across a city, that, we're not by any stretch the answer. We're making big mistakes every single day, but I know what's possible because it's, we're beating the odds in a very, very significant way. We're the total outlier to where the city is going. Nationally, I'm always an optimist, but I'm also a realist. The question is, does this moment become more than that? I think that's incumbent upon all of us across the country and, locally and nationally to behave in some radically different ways. And there's nothing inevitable about progress. And I think we've seen as a nation, speaking personally, I think we've gone backwards in some extraordinarily significant ways over the past couple years. I will tell you, maybe too honest sometimes, I thought when I was at Chicago Public Schools that as long as Black and brown kids are being killed, nobody would care. It would take white kids being killed for anyone to care. And then we had Sandy Hook. And Sandy Hook was the worst day of the president's presidency. He deals the hardest issues on the planet. I never anticipated, 20 white babies and 5 teachers and a principal being killed. And post that, as a country, we got 0 done in terms of reducing gun violence. And we've seen, these shootings continue. So what I thought it would take to break through wasn't even close. So if we are to do something different now, I'm just repeating myself, we have to behave in radically different ways. We have to make ourselves much more uncomfortable than we've ever been. And we got to collaborate and do some things that we have been too comfortable to do.
Arnie, I appreciate that. And Carol, I want to shift to you. And Carol, right before I shift to you, I've got 2 questions. Carol, shift to you. I want to invite the audience to leave questions in the chat. I know a number of you have. and know that I'm paying attention to those, and I'm going to try and weave in some of your questions throughout. So please feel free to go into the chat where it says Q&A underneath the boxes you're seeing, and add questions in the chat if you've got questions. Carol, two questions for you as you think about what's going on. One, what is the boldest idea you've heard thus far? And I know you're probably in a particularly interesting position because being a part of an academic institution, you're not only hearing from other kind of scholars and professors, but I assume you're probably hearing from some of your students as well, who I assume probably have a number of creative ideas. So number one, what's the boldest idea you've heard? And then number two, for those like Arnie and myself and you and others who fear that there may not be movement and that people won't do, that this could be more temporary than any of us would ever want, any thoughts as to how we make this not a temporary moment and how we actually turn this into something that leads to sustained change? So both questions, and I know both of those questions are a mouthful, but number one, what's the boldest or maybe just most interesting idea you've heard that you think could make a difference here? And then number two, any thoughts as to how this doesn't become just a brief moment?
Yeah. So maybe I can go at that question by picking up on something that Arnie and Chip both mentioned. And that is, I think we really have to radically shift how we think about this, right? And so, and that means that following Ibram Kendi, or we have to say, you know, if you aren't an anti-racist, you are a racist. And the question I would ask is, you know, does a particular policy perpetuate racial inequity? If it perpetuates racial inequity, whether the word race occurs in that policy or not, it is a racist policy. And that means completely changing how we think about a lot of things that benefit us, right? So it's like, what are we willing to give up in order to build a genuinely anti-racist place, whether it's a college campus, a town, a city, a police department, whatever it is. And that is a real radical shift in orientation. It sounds, I mean, I'm an academic, right? So I'm going to go with the idea first. And it sounds like if we can get people actually to think in that way, then every how we lend money, how capital works, the relationship between capital and labor, how we police, how, you know, who has access to what, all of that looks different if we ask that question, right? And so if we ask that question with everything that we do on our campus will look really different. And that means that in some sense, from the curriculum to our business processes, to how we hire, to how we relate to our own community, to how we relate to our employees, all of that looks different if we just make this shift. And I think it requires white people to not be defensive at all and to recognize our institutional and collective accountability for inestimable harm that we could never compensate for in any kind of sense of the word justice, right? But how are we accountable in the present for that harm in a way that doesn't provoke a lot of defensiveness and kind of resistance? So I think if we can make that shift, a lot of things, we'll see the world differently. We will see the world differently, and our imperative to act will be stronger, and we will find the sense of obligation and commitment to do the work that we need to do and to get out of the way of people, of Black people and people of color as we try to build a genuinely inclusive environment.
Hear, hear. Well said, Carol.
Carol, if I push you on that, and Chip, I'll come to you. If you know, you saw in Portland, I think it was, you saw the police chief step down and say, to your point, that we're going to have to make some tangible sacrifices. And so I think that police chief stepped down so that an African-American deputy would step in. You saw Alexis Ohanian, the co-founder of Reddit, step down from the board of Reddit as part of that. I mean this for everyone. How would you, if you asked yourself, what could I, Carol, do? What would I be willing to do in order to facilitate that? Have you had time to think about that? And if so, what would you be willing to do? And what do you think would be valuable for you to do?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think the question, you know, as in my current job, I think there's one answer to that question. And then personally, I think there's a slightly different answer to that question. In my job, I think, you know, setting in motion this shift in how we think about our institutional processes and what we do, and then empowering people who have the vision to create the place that we want to create to do that work. I think that is a combination of clearing the way and then getting out of the way. In terms of, you know, my personal life, you know, I mean, I think being accountable for hundreds of years of horrific injustice personally means shifting with some of the things that Arnie mentioned, shifting, you know, who we trust, how we engage, what communities we invest in, how we think about our philanthropy, right? Or how we think about our community engagement work, how we think about our activism and who is empowered to do that. And, you know, to me, sort of allyship means sort of standing in solidarity with agendas that I have no place setting. You know what I mean? And so I think that that's being willing to, you know, argue for things that have a financial or personal cost. I mean, being willing to, you know, try to level the playing field in some material way.
Chip, let me bring you into this. I thought that what you shared with me in exchange you had with one of your staff members, I thought to the extent that you feel comfortable sharing it, sure. I thought it was a very honest moment that probably more than a few people can relate to. Would you share
sure.
that?
So when Carlos and I were talking ahead of the call, first of all, Carol, I love what you said. And, you know, we're trying to, you know, obviously we're a company, right? We're trying to focus on the company internally in terms of how we turn the innovation inward to really drive us into an anti-racist position, like much more actively internally. And I'll talk about that in a second. But, you know, in getting there, you know, we had this, when I say eruption internally, we are a diverse company. And right after George Floyd, honestly, having done this for 12 years, I have never seen anything. And I mean, you know, it's my third startup, but 2U is, you know, the one that's had the greatest growth trajectory, no question. And I've never seen anything like what I saw internally. And so it was challenging on all levels. You know, I've learned that regardless of the position that we believe we're coming from and that we've been intentional in diversifying the board and diversifying the executive team, that one has to really be willing to look at how much more we have to do and center not on me, but on our team and on our company and what we can do to really become anti-racist and really even learning what that means. And so having not come from a place of economic privilege, where Carlos was going, is I was trying to get my head wrapped around this, because if I give you some aspect of how I define myself, you know, as a human, as a person, drive and sort of what I've been able to accomplish having not come from means is very much part of my own self-concept. You know, I feel like I've had to claw my way to get where I am, and it's a big part of how I define myself. And so really getting to understand my privilege and really learning about it from an allyship standpoint and understanding that I have definitive privilege, even though I didn't have any economic privilege. So, you know, we had this internal, our Black employees have an internal business resource network called the Black Engagement Network. And, you know, they had, right after George Floyd, had an open forum, and I came to it, and, you know, it kind of blew my mind. And I had to get myself wrapped around what I was hearing, in that regardless of my economic privilege, that I still have this definitive amount of white privilege. And right when I thought I had my mind around it, I was talking to my assistant, who's Black, and, you know, she's incredible. She knows me really well, and she's okay with me sharing the story. And we were talking about how, you know, that if I had, you know, I was talking to her about if I had some, if a Black man or Black woman had all of the attributes I have, the drive, the sort of risk tolerance, the smarts to figure out here or there, and ultimately was in the same position as me, that because they're Black, it would have been, what I said to her, you know, significantly harder to pull this off. And she goes, or it would have been impossible. You know, she jumped in, sort of cut me off, or it would have been impossible. And even in that moment, when I thought I was getting it, you know, I really hadn't fully processed it. And sort of taking that moment of vulnerability and being comfortable to talk about that with our 4,000 employees and process what that means, how much more as an ally we have to do. And then a CEO also, not just learning, but driving change into the org in a meaningful way. So, you know, over the past 30 days, we've done a whole bunch of things that, you know, we're trying to control what we can control inside the company. So an example is we added a diversity component to our bonus structure for next year. And, you know, that's us trying to definitively deliver where we can, not, you know, allyship training across the board, but really being able to move the dial for to you takes you being willing to, you know where you have so much more to go and being vulnerable. And as Carol said, not being defensive about where the company needs to go, because it doesn't matter where you came from. We all have so much more we can do. And as a white ally, and, you know, funny thing, Carlos, is you know me pretty well. And also one of the employees told me, you know, when you're in this conversation, you have to be comfortable not being Beyonce or Kelly. You also got to be Michelle. And so sort of taking a step back and being willing to have the conversation and not try to put us front and center, but put the employees front and center has also been part of the journey. So I just can't overstate the extraordinary 45 days we've had as a company. And it does make me really optimistic. I know Arnie's talking about, you know, some of the tragedy. And, you know, I had one employee say to me, you know, we have sons that are both about to go to college. And, you know, she really moved me when she said, you know, we're both worried about a lot of things, but the one thing you don't have to worry about is when mine gets to college, I'm worried about him getting killed. And, you know, I don't have to worry about that. That realization alone is just super meaningful. With that said, I do think this is a different moment. I think this is different. You know, at least inside a company, I can tell you this, our employee, my Black employees are very worried that, you know, even the tenor of the last week or two has calmed down. There's less about this now. And, you know, our Black employees are worried that we're all just going to move on. And we have an obligation as leaders to not just move on, to really deliver. And so I'm trying to take it on internally in a way that hopefully creates meaningful change.
Chip, I appreciate that. And thank you for that. And thank you for sharing that. Penny, talk to me a little bit about what the last 6 to 8 weeks have been like for you. I mean, to some extent, I imagine there's a lot of this that you've been thinking about over the years, given that you've had a number of different vantage points. But have there been major learning moments for you over the last 6 to 8 weeks? And how, if at all, is that informing, you know, what you do next?
Well, there are a couple of, you asked a question about what's the boldest idea I've heard. And I'll start by saying, I've been trying to do a lot of listening and learning because I don't have the answers. And I also don't even have instincts about what the right answers are. I mean, I know we need more diversity in the organizations that I'm involved with, whether they're for-profit or nonprofit. But that's been something we've been focused on for a long time. And the fact that you go back and look at the data again and realize that progress is really slow or is mercurial, you make progress and then a few people leave and your data looks worse and yet you're not really at a sustained place that you want to be. All of that makes me step back and say, I have a lot to learn. So I come at this, and I mean this with a lot of humility. I'm not on the front lines the way Arnie is, nor am I on the front lines running a large organization. But the boldest idea I heard was that there are probably, and I'm going to, my data won't be precisely accurate, but it is that there are roughly 6 million African Americans between the age of 18 and 25. And this is not my idea, but it's something that's really interesting. Ken Frazier at Merck said, We need to adopt every one of them, and not legally adopt them. They need a mentor, each one of them, and an opportunity. And to me, you know, I'm interested in, we need massive systemic change if on many levels in order to achieve the vision that all of us have been working towards, but all we've been doing is making like little incremental steps. And frankly, you go back and look at the data, and the steps are actually, if you look back over 50 years, one could argue were worse. Because while African-American population has gone from over 50 years, a sixth grade average education to a high school education, that's not good enough anymore for the job world that we live in, right? And so what's gone wrong there? And I'm picking African-American population as because I think you have to look separately at the different races in order to see what's really happening and understand. The other is, if you look at the lowest quintile of African-American males, 50 years ago, they were all employed, and today none are employed. I'm being extreme, but I'm being, I'm not precisely accurate, but I'm directionally accurate in what I've just said. And so what does that do, you know, to a group if when those are facts? And so to me, I'm trying to understand, I've spent the last 6 weeks trying to, there's the anecdotal, I'm living in my own company or our own organizations. There are the different approaches. You know, every organization has a bit of a different approach. Everybody wants a consultant to help them. But I'm not sure even how to judge if the consultant's advice is valid. And I'm trying to figure out where do we belong besides our own responsibility in our own organization to improve inclusion, right? Where do we belong? What are the big ideas and that might change? And then also not lose sight of, I think what Arnie said is really important, which is he's got a proof point of what's working in a community in Chicago. And how do we then get our government to take the, what I'm going to call venture capital ideas that are working and take them to scale? My problem is we're doing too much stuff at a little bit and not enough where it's having scale. And so those are some of the things that I've been focused on. I don't have a plan yet. It's not like I'm sitting here saying, oh, I got it all figured out. Here's what we're going to do. I really am recognize we're a work in progress. This is, what is my role as the white liberal philanthropist who hasn't really helped the situation? The data tells you that. What's my role as a civic leader? And I'm focused on this notion of scale. We have got to turn this around at scale. We can't, and maybe the way to do that is what Arnie's saying, community by community. But then how do we get that done?
I like Ken's thought, Ken Frazier's thought there about the mentoring. I like the scaling. Let me ask for your reaction to a couple of ideas, Penny. When you hear the conversation around reparations that has been around for a long time, Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote about it a number of years ago and really kind of brought it back into the conversation. And obviously there's been fresh conversation around it, in no small part because of some of the data you cited about unemployment and about wealth disparity, et cetera. How do you hear something like that? Does it pull you in? Does it repel you? Do you stand at the side? How do you hear that conversation around something like reparations?
So I don't know what reparations means specifically. And the question, I'm not repelled, nor am I drawn in. I have questions. How would an initiative that we call reparations, whatever that is, how does that actually change the situation for the better? You know, you go to some of these communities, you know, we're doing this thing called the Chicago Prize. We last week I was in Auburn, Gresham, and North Lawndale, and Austin, and a number of communities. And you look at these communities, there's been no investment. I mean, the investment is all either city dollars or federal dollars. There's no private investment going on. So you ask yourself, if I'm growing up, if I'm that person growing up in a community where I've never seen a private investment, what is that impact on me? So my question about reparations would be, okay, what does that lead to? How does that work? So, and how do we do that in a way where it creates a more opportunity for the populations that we're going to provide reparations to? We're spending money. The question is, are we spending it in a way that it's working? And are we learning from the things that folks like Arnie are doing or others are doing that work? And are we taking those to scale? And are we analyzing what's not working? I mean, I look in the, and I'll one more thing and then I will be quiet, but I look in the technology world and obviously Chip lives there and Carol, by virtue of the people she's training, you know, how do we get more people of color in throughout the system in technology? That for me is, how do we have an inclusive tech talent pipeline is for me an important issue. As a citizen of Chicago, because we have a very diverse population, and as somebody who sees it from the being on the board of Microsoft, you know, that is a huge question. And that's a long-term training question, an education question, an opportunity question, and touches on everything. How does reparations help someone get into a positive opportunity situation, whether it's in technology or not, so that they can thrive and their families can thrive, and that they can be optimistic and they can see investment in their communities? These are the things that are going on in my head. I do not have this figured out, how to make change at scale. And there are others like the Business Roundtable that are focused on this, and they have multiple initiatives from a business standpoint that I think are important. And those are places I think from a commerce and economy standpoint are important leaders, because they represent scale.
Point taken on the scale and on the technology piece as well. Arnie, let me put you back in government, if you don't mind, because as Penny's pointing out, there are kind of a number of different players in the conversation. And Chip, I want to ask you in a bit about what role ambitious CEOs could play in reshaping this conversation. But Arnie, if I were to put you back in government, you know, are there a handful of policy initiatives that you think could have the kind of scale change that Penny is interested in and that Penny raised?
Yeah, so whether it's government or not government, I, you know, just a couple, you know, I'll give you four quick ideas just to think about that you can use governmental levers, public policy levers, or private sector levers. First is, I just think at the end of the day, all we're trying to do is build healthy communities in the Black and Brown community. And if you look at Boston, you know, a couple of years ago, Boston, the average white family was worth $258,000, and the average Black family was worth $9. And there's, you know, study after study, you know, last 20 years, whites with college degrees, their income has doubled. and blacks with college degrees, their income's gone down 10%. So when you play by the rules, you still don't make it. So one thing would be just to have absolute transparency for public companies, private companies, what I call anchor institutions, like universities, like Carroll's University, like hospitals, like museums, just to have a public scorecard of what's the diversity of your board, what's the diversity of your management team, and what's your spend on the business side. And I'm not talking about who your gardeners are, who your cooks are, who your landscapers are, but who's your accountant, who's your lawyer, who does your PR, who does your technology, to Penny's point. And even if it's a majority firm, do you have a minority partner at that majority firm doing the work? And absent public transparency, absent the willingness to just, you know, hold ourselves accountable wherever we are, that's the baseline, and try and get better, then we'll just keep talking about it. And it's the, you know, I'm just a big believer in data. Just put it out there, and good, bad, the ugly. So that would be one, just public transparency, public companies, private companies, anchor institutions. Let's learn from each other. Let's see who moves. The University of Chicago has done some amazing, amazing things here that have created wealth and are creating businesses, and black folks hire black folks. And that's just got to be part of what we commit to doing. So that's one. Secondly, and this is a chicken or egg thing that the communities that I'm working in that Penny talked about, businesses have left. And I can't say that's irrational, because many of them are war zones. And so we're trying to hold ourselves accountable for reducing the bullets flying. But we have to have jobs in communities, and we used to have that. And while downtown is booming, is blossoming, is beautiful, there are not legal ways to make money in the communities. And so we have to do both. We have to reduce the violence and make them safer, but we actually have to have businesses on blocks that people can walk by, kids can walk by, they can see people going to work. That's the irony. Back in the days of segregation, you had in one community, you had teachers, you had dentists, you had lawyers. Now with integration, the black professionals have left, and you know the underclass, you know, the poorest are left, and they don't know anyone on the block who goes to a regular job. So that has to change. Third, again, talk about making ourselves uncomfortable. We have to be willing to hire people with criminal backgrounds. And we have all these things. And again, I don't just take someone right out of jail and hire them. That's not what I'm saying. But if people go through a process, it can transform their lives. It can move to a very different space. We can't hold what they did at 16 or 17 against them forever. Because I always say, people are going to make money. They're going to eat. They're going to have a roof over their head. They're going to feed their kids. And it's going to be in the legal economy or in the legal economy. And folks that have had everything stacked against themselves now have this stacked against themselves. And we've had about 40, 45 employers who are hiring our men with, frankly, violent, you know, felony backgrounds. And we got a couple guys working in law firms. We got a guy working Deloitte. That's amazing. But we got to do a hell of a lot more of that. And people have to be willing to take those risks on people who have demonstrated their commitment to transforming their lives. And then the one that the sort of current conversation post George Floyd is the whole defund, you know, police thing. I don't love the word defund. I like, you know, reimagine. But I'll just give one example. Here in Chicago, we are 3 to 4 times more violent than LA, but we have twice as many police per person as LA does. So we have way more police, but still 3 to 4 more times more violence. So clearly more and more police have not solved our problems here. This is, again, hyper-local, but just for the audience, just to understand, we have about 13,000 police. Let's just say instead of 13,000, we had 10,000. And let's say those police at the end of the salary scale are worth at least $100,000, probably more. 3,000 times 100,000, that's $300 million. That's a lot of money to do outreach, to have social workers, to have clinicians, to do all the work that, you know, we're doing, funding through the private side. And let's try it and let's see what happens. And the reason we're getting better results in one neighborhood is we're investing massively in that stuff, but we need some public resources to do it. So let's think about that differently. The current mayor doesn't quite understand it yet. You know, we'll keep working on it. She said, well, if you do that, you have to fire all the young police. They're more diverse. You don't want to do that. That's not what I'm proposing. We have an aging workforce. We have 900 police officers retiring each year. Let's just let them retire. Let's not fire anybody. Rather than replacing 900 with 900, let's replace 900 with 300 or 200 or none or whatever the number is. And let's try and come at this with a different way, help communities heal, create the safety that would then hopefully compel people to invest back in. And right now we have a destructive cycle. We need to build a virtuous cycle. And again, we've been unwilling to do those things.
Arnie, appreciate all of those ideas, all of those examples. Chip, take me inside. You're running a company day to day, as you said. It started small. Today, you're employing 7,000 people. For a completely ambitious CEO, what can she or he do if they really want to be an ambitious ally here? And I say that, and I didn't ask the question nearly as artfully as I want. But what some of the comments, some of the questions in the Q&A are basically saying, I'm hearing a lot of nice talk.
Yeah, what are you going to do?
Really in this conversation, but they're saying more broadly over the last 6 to 8 weeks. But that what they are experiencing so far, and granted 6 to 8 weeks, so it may not be a long time, is not yet translating into new investment, is not yet translating into different hiring, is not yet translating into new promotions. And so, again, sure. there's an understanding in the question that it's only 6 to 8 weeks, but there's also a little concern what will happen over 6 to 8 months, what will happen over 6 to 8 years. So from your vantage point, which is a nice one, healthy, growing, young company, what do you think you or other creative CEOs can do?
Well, first, being comfortable, being uncomfortable, being comfortable knowing that you don't know everything and that you have a lot to learn here. That's a place to start. But as we translate to go from intention to impact, I can just tell you the things we've committed to our employees. First of all, I agree entirely with Arnie that sunlight wins. So we're publishing all the diversity data. We're publishing it both internally and externally. So, being willing to share with the world where we are and share with our employees, most importantly, they're critical stakeholders for us to be able to do everything we need to do. So starting there with sunlight, but, we're revising the recruitment journey. We're doing an objective and consistent approach to compensation and career development, because that's where the systemic bias can show up most harmfully. We're auditing all of our vendors and suppliers. What I'm personally most excited about is adding a diversity, equity, and inclusion component to the corporate bonus plan. I feel like that's us putting our money where our mouth is and making it intentional at both the senior level and the manager level to ensure that we're willing to deliver based on it. And then the training, I just went through our allyship training. It's 2 hours. And I learned a ton. It's like, these are moments where one can actually improve not just yourself, but improve the company by being intentional about doing these things. Now, that's the internal focused work. Externally, we're very excited about what the company can do with its product. Social mobility is real coming out of our programs. And so, we were careful to not announce to our employees too many sort of what I was worried would be seen as one-off responses. We invested in this, we did this, but rather we're trying to build things directly into the fabric of the business. So one thing that we did announce is a $3 million scholarship fund for our technical boot camps for people of color. And, I think Penny mentioned it, that technology training is critical, and that's what a big part of our business does. And so being intentional there, and we have a couple of things that'll come out in the next month that we're really excited about. One with a very big corporate partner, and then one with one of our university partners that'll be super responsive, but I just can't talk about it yet. So I feel like, as a CEO trying to do what I can do internally, what I am excited about is I do believe we're in a new era here. The combination of it's fascinating. I think I mentioned this to you, Carlos, that we have a very intensely millennial workforce. And, what I've always loved about our millennial employees is they will very definitively tell me what they think. And the combination of a diverse workforce with an intensely millennial workforce is, from a stakeholder standpoint, we must improve in a bunch of places for us to be a model of not just how to be diverse, but to be equitable and inclusive. And even understanding what that means has been a journey for, the upper layers of the company. So, but I'm excited about it. I feel wind at my back to actually make a difference. So I don't want to be the eternal optimist, but I do feel like we can actually move the dial. And if we do it internally, hopefully we can become a model for other companies. We're certainly not there yet. We have a long way to go, but we got to try.
Chip, I would say that you may be in a uniquely good position because you guys are young enough that there's still a lot of flexibility. But you guys are also established enough and you're on your way to the scale that Penny talked about, that that there's a chance for you to have to be seen as a meaningful example to other companies. So I hope you maintain that optimism. Penny, a quick word to you. And then guys, believe it or not, we're over time. I was having such a good time that Carol, I thought this was an hour and I forgot that it was only 45 minutes. So we're over time. So Penny, I'll give you a quick word. And then Carol, if you don't mind, I'll let you close us out.
Sure. I'll just say one thing, which is that I think that all of us agree here that in order to make the change that we want and have the investment in the communities that we're talking about, we have to be intentional. And we're going to have to like live our values. And all of us who are enjoy privilege, you know, to whom much is given to all of us, we, you know, much is expected. And I think that, and certainly that's how I was raised. And I think all of us on this panel feel the same. You know, and what we're talking about is going to require investment in these communities that we're discussing. It's not just our hiring, but it's also going to require more investment in these communities. And we need to make sure that that's done in a way that it can provide opportunity for everybody. You know, we need a greater social safety net for folks in these communities too. So there's just a lot of work to do and it requires intentional leadership by all of us. And I think what's exciting is that whether it's in education or in community investment or in business or in others, you're seeing people really want to make a change and want to make a difference and recognizing that it's inhuman what's happening. In that respect, I'm optimistic because there's enormous momentum and enthusiasm. And I would underscore what Chip said. The millennial working in every one of our organizations is not going to let us sit on our hands. But we as leaders, we've got to basically wake up and try and embrace the change that we're trying to accomplish.
I appreciate that. And I agree with you about the youthful energy that I feel like is keeping this robust. Carol, final word to you. And if you don't mind bringing us home over the next minute or two, what's your final thought as you participate in this conversation, which I know is one of many that you've been having about how to make change real?
So I appreciate the opportunity, but I don't feel quite up to the task of closing this conversation out entirely. So I think what I would say is we, particularly white people, tend to underestimate the embeddedness of these racist structures in our world. And that to really commit oneself to imagining rebuilding this country that I love in such a way so that we're actually equipped to honor the values that compel my love for the country, that's a huge, huge task. And it's not something to be undertaken lightly. And even a conversation about something like a tech pipeline, well, how do we judge talent and what do we value? And how do we look at communities for the incredible strengths that they exhibit and not in terms of deficits? And how do we think about these processes that structure our lives and from which we ourselves have benefited enormously, right? Because we're good at this stuff, right? How do we prepare ourselves to let go of that and to imagine a world that is genuinely inclusive? And I think it's really hard. And so I think it's imperative. I think the advantage of a small community like a college campus, you know, is that you have that or a small company, right? A startup company, you have the opportunity to experiment and to really try to root out this stuff, you know, and reimagine it in a truly equitable way. So to me, that's the challenge, and it's huge. And I am grateful that everyone on this call is so committed to undertaking it, and that has made such, you know, the effort of the folks of all of you has made such a big difference so far. So thank you for the opportunity to be a part of to be with people who have already in their lives done so much.
Carol, I want to thank you, Chip, you, Penny, Arnie. Thank all four of you for a terrific conversation. I too am hopeful and optimistic. Chip, like you, I feel like something different is happening. I have that fear in my gut about whether it will be temporary, but I have also that hope that that it will be transformational and that people will be bold in it. There were so many good comments in the Q&A section, including people pointing to the article that Arnie mentioned in the New York Times. A number of you pointed to interesting pieces on reparations and other things. Some of you pointed to interesting things that various companies and universities are doing. So if you guys haven't partaken in that, please do so. Finally, and maybe most importantly, the goodness continues. Jeff Livingston, a good friend of mine, is about to kick off what will be another terrific conversation here, and it's going to start properly now, and we'll run the full length. And Jeff, I hand the baton to you.
Thank you so much, Carlos. Thank you so much, Carlos, and thank you for hosting such a fascinating conversation. I am Jeff Livingston. I am CEO of Ed Solutions and co-founder of the Center for Education Market Dynamics. It is my honor to present the next panel and to moderate this panel, which is a very exciting one for me. I have an advantage over the rest of you who are listening in as much as I know why these are the right people to be engaged in this conversation, and many of you do not. So in the next couple of minutes, I hope to help you to understand who they are, why these are the people to talk about this conversation, and I hope they will be joining me in just a second on your screens so that we can get started with our panel. Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. So what I hope to have happen today in the few minutes that we have here is that we will explore a continuing conversation that started fascinatingly a couple of weeks ago when five people whom I know and revere and love in this same virtual space had a fascinating conversation that began with Dr. Mahalia Hines questioning whether segregation was a good idea. And when I heard her say that, I went, wow, right? And I didn't go wow because I hadn't heard those ideas before. I said wow because of where I was hearing those ideas. I usually hear them, you know, between the dressing and the mac and cheese at dinner at my mother's house, because lots of people of her generation have decided that. But it said to me that something new and different is happening, and I'm pleased to be a part of the conversation here. So my role here today is to be a stand-in for those of you in the audience and to have the conversation with these amazing people that I want to have with them, and through me, that you can have with them as well. And so in order to do that, let me spend just a minute more explaining how I come to this conversation, and then we will bring in the important people into the conversation. So as I have been thinking about this, I went back to a conversation more than 30 years old now with a professor in college who was my favorite professor in college, who in a conversation with me said, that the movement for the full inclusion of Black people into American life has at least two branches. One of those is tree shakers, Dr. Martin Kilson said, and the other is jelly makers. Dr. Kilson said that tree shakers are the people who grab a hold of the tree, shake it so hard that the fruit comes loose, and that the jelly makers were the people who came along, gathered up the fruit, and turned it into something substantive for the community. Now, he challenged me in that moment to remember that I was being trained to be a jelly maker, but that the minute the trees stopped getting shaked, I started starving. That jelly making is a safer part of the movement than tree shaking. So I have a special responsibility to be supportive of the tree shakers. And that there is a risk that we jelly makers forget that it's the tree shakers who start the process, that we can't do what we do unless they do what they do. And so I very, very personally, as someone who was born to be a jelly maker, trained to be a jelly maker, worked hard to be a jelly maker, get to speak to people who are shaking the trees, getting them to expand my thinking and remind me of what all of this is about. Now, each of the people on this panel has been given not only permission, but begged to push me out of my comfort zone. And therefore, I hope to push you out of your comfort zone too. And so let me get started by bringing them into the conversation so that you can come to know what I know, which is that this is exactly the right panel of people to be discussing this. Ashley Munson, can we start with you? I think of you as both a tree shaker and a jelly maker. So even in your very existence, you already challenged my assumption that I had to pick. Can you explain to our audience today who you are and what you do and why I would say such a thing about you?
Sure. First, Jeff and the GSV team, so grateful to be here along with my panel colleagues. So I'm Ashley Munson. My 9-to-5 is I am a legislative affairs manager for the Illinois Network of Charter Schools. However, my 5-to-9, I am a community leader and activist. And so Jeff, in describing me, I am both a tree shaker and a jelly maker because I call myself the liaison from the streets to the statehouse. I think it's important that both understand each other's roles and that we unite and move forward in a way that we haven't traditionally had to. And because that's an important part of civic education and having policymakers create the policies that we're rattling the tree for. And it's important that the tree shakers understand the policymakers and their values and why they're doing the work. So I would distinguish myself as both. And I hope to continue this fight and move forward to make both parties understand one another.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I understand that you also turned a tweet into a demonstration of several thousand people just a couple of weeks ago. Could you tell us just a little bit about that?
Sure. So I was in the midst of the rioting and looting that occurred after George Floyd. I was doing some research about the history of rioting and looting and protests. And so I made a tweet saying that wouldn't it be nice or cool, however I worded it, if we had a million man march in Chicago. And that tweet turned into a lot of responses in which we had 11 days to plan this march that was on Juneteenth at Daley Plaza. So it went from a tweet to over 5,000 people, young and old, millennials, boomers, Gen Zers, coming out to support the Black heritage, but also willing to fight and stand for what they wanted to stand for, in addition to what are we doing and what's next. So I had the honor of leading that movement. And from that, we have developed a nonprofit, which we could talk about later. But I'm honored to have led that movement for our generation and to move forward for a people as a whole.
Thank you so much. Way to shake the trees. I really appreciate it. Sharonda Bossier, I, like you, have lots of friends who are not Americans. And those friends who live outside the country enjoy pointing out the ways in which Americans are different in ways that don't help the rest of the planet. And in a recent conversation, one of them pointed out to me that Americans are, in his estimation, more warlike because no Americans have living memories of invading armies marching past our front doors the way that lots of Europeans do, lots of Asians do, lots of Africans do, lots of Latin Americans do. But people from the United States don't know what it is to be invaded by armed men. And it occurs to me that some of us do know what that is like. Some of us have known what that is like for two generations in the same neighborhood, and three generations if you go back further. I believe you are one of these people. Could you explain to our audience why I would say that and introduce yourself in the way that you think best?
Yeah. Thanks for having me. My name is Sharonda Bossier. I'm the Deputy Director at EdLoc, Education Leaders of Color, and I am a native of Los Angeles, California. I grew up in the Watts section of the city, and I know very much what it's like to have an occupying force into your neighborhood. I am 36, and that has happened in my lifetime twice in my city. Most recently, when the National Guard was deployed in response to some of the protests in response to the killing of George Floyd. And then also in 1992, when I was 8 years old, right? And I remember distinctly what it was like to have armed police officers, armed National Guards troops in our communities, and to see them and to know that they actually weren't there to protect me or to protect my family. My mother was 7 when Watts erupted in riots in 1965, right? And so for my family, it has just been a constant source of both pain and anguish to know that when we see troops roll in, that they are there to penalize us for demanding that this system respect and see our humanity, right? And I think about what it was like for my grandparents who migrated here from Louisiana. My grandfather was the son of sharecroppers, right? And in 2016, I was in Baton Rouge protesting the police killing of Alton Sterling. And that was one of the most heavily militarized police forces I ever encountered. And that was home. And my family was definitely worried about my physical safety when I was there. And so when people talk about Americans not knowing what it is like to have an armed occupying force in your communities, I say that you have not talked to poor Americans, you have not talked to poor Black Americans, you have not talked to poor Brown Americans, because if you just asked us, we would tell you the number of times police, National Guardsmen, sheriffs, deputies, et cetera, have swarmed and invaded our communities in the name of keeping the peace. And it's really been about controlling us, our bodies, and our calls for liberation.
Thank you, Sharonda. Anurima, I am interested in this conversation as a part of my own process of growth. And one of the things I am doing is moving from what I pray has been a non-racist past instantiation of myself into an anti-racist present and future. And we just heard the president of Davidson College say, if you're not an anti-racist, you're a racist. The way I understand that in my journey is that non-racism is about the condition of my heart, is about my intentions. Anti-racism is about focusing on consequences and outcomes. I can have every inch. If I support a system that is racist, then if I do things that result in racially disparate impacts, then I am behaving as a racist. It occurs to me that as a civil rights lawyer, Anu, you know something about this difference between intent and impact. And I wonder if you would discuss that a little bit as you also introduce yourself.
Sure. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here with all of you. Let me just start by saying I come here in solidarity and from the work. I am not Black and I have not lived the Black experience. I am someone who grew up on the South Side of Chicago in public schools. And it's very much animated the reason why I am a racial justice lawyer and have tried to spend my career working on addressing the ways in which intention and impact have shown up in how our schools are segregated. And I don't just mean in where our children are sitting, but in the modern forms of segregation, like discipline and how we treat and how we identify students with disabilities. I think about it in the ways in which our schools, our systems have been built and how we've invested in them, which is part of the conversation that was just had, but part of the conversation I'm sure we will have now, where we have 2-year-old metal detectors and 20-year-old books. And it's very much in terms of bringing a lens, the anti-racism lens of always interrogating. And I would say that we are always interrogating, Jeff, both in intent and impact. It can't be one or the other. There's a belief right now that if we have good intentions, if we're not really trying to be racist, then whatever happens in terms of those consequences are a natural flow. But I think the ways in which we think about, and we've moved away in the law in that way too, which is to say, if you're not doing it in an intentionally racist way, that somehow or another, it's not something you need to be accountable for or to change. And I think what we have to look at is not only what our intentions are, but what our impacts are. And that happens all the time. And whether or not we are not just playing on the margins, but are we designing the system of power and investment differently to lift up and to support Black and brown children in America? So I think we have to do that in how we embed and not just in how we treat on the back end what we're doing in terms of our schooling.
Thank you so much, Anu. Brandon, just a few minutes ago, I got the announcement of the next cohort of tech entrepreneurs that Fast Forward in San Francisco is celebrating. And it occurs to me that you and I met when you were being celebrated by that same organization for your work. And it feels like it was a long time ago because you have been so important to my own thinking. And I say that because you challenge me a lot. You forced me to see the world through your eyes, and I have thanked you for that many times, and I do so again publicly. Here, I have heard you describe yourself, Brandon, as a Black queer abolitionist. I think I know what Black means. I think I'm coming to understand what queer means. I'm not at all sure I know what abolitionist means in this context, though I do suspect. Would you please enlighten me as to what those labels mean, if you still use them, and tell our audience why it is that you have come to this conversation as well?
Yeah. First, I am super honored to be in the presence of so many beautiful people. So thank you so much for inviting me to this conversation. It's already the best panel I've been a part of or have listened to. You're right, I am a Black queer abolitionist. I am a Black queer abolitionist, and I'm also the founder of Raheem. And Raheem is an Oakland-based national nonprofit and the independent service for reporting police violence in the United States. When you report to Raheem, we connect you to a free lawyer, we file a complaint against the police officer, and then we use your reports to lobby for policies that shrink the role of police and invest in Black people. We are a group of talented, passionate, mostly Black organizers, data scientists, and product designers working to end police terror against Black people. I was born and raised in Oklahoma during the 1980s crack epidemic and the 1990s global HIV pandemic. My great-grandfather was the single only African-American surgeon during the 1921 race massacre, when hundreds of Black people were burned alive and killed by white terrorists. And his son, my grandfather, organized in the early 1960s and 70s as the only, as the first African-American man to own a nightclub in Oklahoma City. Police harassed him and his customers so much so that he needed to shut his doors. He turned to alcoholism. I met him for the very first time when I was 16 years old. He died when I was 19. I was born to his daughter, my mother, who in 1994 went to prison and lost her rights, her parenting rights to me, because a police officer planted crack paraphernalia. My mother had never smoked crack in her life. She had become addicted to crack cocaine while in prison, lost her parenting rights to me. I met her for the first time when I was 15 years old. That same year, I fell in love to a tall, skinny, big-headed Black boy who I had first met in third grade English class. We had been through just about everything together, from grade school, junior high school, and high school. We lived homeless for 2 years, and I fell in love with him in an abandoned house next to a used car dealership. And in 2006, he asked me to marry him, which was quite frankly one of the most beautiful days of my life. He moved on to become a painter a year later, and I was in the Army for 5 years. In 2007, my life partner, fiance, and very best friend was shot and killed by Oklahoma City Police Department during a routine traffic stop. His love was radical, unapologetic, and it changed my life. Hearing about those lived experiences, starting first at my great-grandfather, then my grandfather, my mother, and then my life partner, my fiance, really, I hope, illuminates the shaping of my lived experiences and what it means for me to be Black. What it means for me to be queer is that when I told my first line supervisor about my partner being shot and I wanted to visit him, I was kicked out of the US Army because I was queer. Because I liked men, I was kicked out of the Army. And so I am unabashedly, you know, queer. We can talk a little bit about what that queerness means. But what's most interested in, that I'm most interested in complicating is what abolition means. And abolition can be both, and is for me, both a strategy and an outcome. And so I wanna live in a world that does not have police at all, period. And the strategy with which I engage my colleagues and friends and the world with is a strategy of abolition. I'm happy to be here and really looking forward to exploring a lot of that.
Thank you so much, Brandon. Thank you for sharing all of that with us. So now our audience understands why you are the people I want to talk to here. I'd love to lean in on this policing issue first, because when I hear, or even when I say, abolish the police, I mean, like Secretary Duncan said a few minutes ago, reorganize, redirect resources, reconceive of policing. Brandon wants to live in a world without police. Let's bring this into the school system as we think about this. I took a sabbatical during a career change a couple of years ago. And while I was in Latin America, I looked up at a CNN in Espanol screen and saw a skinny young African-American girl being thrown across a classroom by a uniformed police officer in South Carolina. Now that touched me deeply for a couple of reasons. One is that I have been both a student and a teacher in that very room. In fact, the video was taken by the daughter of a classmate of mine, and I have a niece who was two doors away in her math class at the time. And I remember going through a lot of emotions. I thought, oh my God, how dare he do that? And I thought, what would happen if that were my niece? And I immediately called my mother and said to her, find out who needs bail money so I can send some. Because where I come from, if especially a young female member of a family is treated that way, several of the male members of her family are immediately going to respond in ways that are violent. When she told me that no such thing had happened, I knew immediately what the world found out later, which was that she had been orphaned and lived in a group home, and that made her especially vulnerable. But what I did not think of until later, that's related to this conversation, is why the hell was there a police officer in that school in the first place? Why, you know, Anu, why are there more schools with police in them than there are with nurses in them? Why is that something we have decided to bring from the outside society into the schools? And should we first abolish policing in school buildings? What do you think, Anu?
So let me just thank you for talking about what happened in South Carolina, which is something we have seen in schools across the nation. And you know, being someone who spent my time, a lot of my time, trying to bring those cases and put some pressure from the legal end, you know, seeing 5-year-olds who are handcuffed and shackled for having a temper tantrum, a little girl in Florida. I mean, I could go on with so many of those instances and places where it's a matter of routine, right? Where 12, 13, 14 kids are arrested per day for doing things like wearing the wrong color socks or rolling their eyes in the wrong way, disrespect, insubordination, things that are subjective. And so we've gotten to a place where when I was growing up in Chicago, we remember who was suspended and expelled, and you remember what they were suspended and expelled for. And now we're in a situation where even in places like Texas, 60% of students in 7th through 12th grade have been suspended or expelled at least once. So it's not just, it's the ways in which we have created a system where the goal is not to keep students in class, but it's an exclusionary practice of setting up a system in which we're perpetuating the fact that we have 1 in 3 Black men who are gonna go to prison and not necessarily to college, right? That is a higher percentage. And so what I would say is there's a reason why 14 million students in America go to schools where there are cops, but there are no nurses, psychologists, counselors, or social workers. And that's because of the ways in which we've thought about, who are good kids and bad kids, how we thought about moving from a system of zero tolerance and saying, well, we're not doing that anymore, but instead, we're just going to police everything that happens within the school building. And it's in relation to what we want to say to our kids about their relationship to authority and their own agency and trauma. And part of what I've spent my time doing in the last couple of years is what structures are leading up to the moments of violence, and then how do we actually think about how do we transform differently from those moments of violence? And I think back to Ferguson, where I talked to so many little kids who said to me they assassinated my hero. And they weren't talking about Michael Brown. They were talking about the African-American superintendent who had been pushed out by an all-white school board 4 months before Michael Brown. And what it means to not have anyone who they can look to who is in those spaces as someone who's supporting their education and supporting an education where in Ferguson Middle School, you don't have 50 students who are arrested per year so that they can get help, right?
That's right.
So that's where I think we have set up the system this way. And it's time for us to set up a system a very different way, back to the question of what's our intent and how we design the spaces that we are educating our children in.
Thank you, Anu. Let me invite all of you on the panel to unmute. The taking turns part of the program is over. We are gonna have an open conversation. And I wanna lean into this more around this notion of policing and schooling, because the physical presence of the cop is not the only way that the culture of incarceration comes into the school, right? Some of you on the panel have personal experience of the impact of incarceration on your families, of the war on drugs, and the way it was conducted on your families, and students bring that to school too, and that also incorporates itself in there. Would anyone like to address that? Or anything else that came up as you have thought about this?
You sort of started your question asking, you know, do we start with sort of defunding or abolishing police in schools? And I think we can do both, right? I think it's a both and. And I think we've seen in places like Los Angeles and Minneapolis where activists have said, you know, we are going to focus both on city police forces, but also the police forces or the divisions of the police force, right, that are focused on schools. And to your question about sort of the culture of policing and how that enters schools. You know, I sort of got my start as an organizer and activist in high school. And my grandfather, who was like really about like, okay, girl, you gonna do your thing. Like I recognize this, right? We walked out one day and across the street from my high school was a sheriff's station, right? And I remember the biggest fear being not that I was going to get in trouble with my teachers who liked me and were permissive in ways they probably shouldn't have been around my activism on campus, right? But that a sheriff's officer or deputy would pick me up for truancy, right? And that being picked up for truancy would be the thing that would again mean my family would have to engage with law enforcement and with the courts, right? And so if you think about what it says to Anarima's point about agency, right, we're talking about who is teaching us, what's happening in our classrooms, what curriculum we have access to, et cetera. And we're like, we're gonna walk out to make a statement, right? And we're gonna walk around the block because we don't really know where else to go, right? We're high schoolers. But if you think about the fact that in trying to exercise my agency and trying to say, here's my voice and here's what matters to me, the thing that I'm most worried about is that I'm going to be picked up by a sheriff's deputy, right? What does that do to me? And what impact does that have on how I think about my role and my voice, both in my school community and in my broader community, right? And so I was very clear that my actions had consequences, not just for me, but for my entire family, right? If I were to be picked up for truancy.
And the ridiculousness that we suspend people for truancy or arrest people for truancy, just that as a very notion is just ridiculous to begin with. Sorry, Ashley.
No, totally fine. I totally agree with both of what they said. But I think one thing that comes to mind for me is thinking about this movement in relation to what we're talking about, right? And so young people have been an integral part of this movement that's going on. And so schools have to watch, learn, and pay attention to this because it's most school-age children who are leading this movement now or being a part of the protests and stuff like that. And in that, you have many school districts and educators that are saying, yeah, I'm pro Black Lives or Black Lives Matter. But then we have to assess, do we really care about Black lives, right? So we have to evaluate the policies that affect directly Black and Brown students in these schools. Why do we say Black Lives Matter when we complicitly take part in student failure? Are we taking part in helping our Black and Brown students, or do we not care? Are we just more focused on the money we get from them attending the school versus their successfulness and how they succeed in life? So I think it's a very important conversation, but I think it's a time for schools to really evaluate, are they really in support of lifting up and elevating Black and Brown students, or are we just doing the bare minimum, if that?
That's important. Brandon, I did something a few weeks ago on Facebook. I'm of the Facebook generation, even though you and I interact on Instagram more. I posted something in a particular way just to get a response. I said, Black men, when was the first time a police officer pulled a gun on you? And I posted that up and invited the Black men in my life to respond. So first off, immediately, Black women and Brown women and Brown men said, hey, it doesn't just happen to you. And I'm like, absolutely right. But I want to see what these answers are. And in the course of about 48 hours, hundreds of people responded, including more than one Obama cabinet official, including more than one college president, including more than one senior leader at a philanthropy, including more than one senior executive at companies that are regular sponsors of the ASU-GSV Summit. One of the things that was really important to me is that I have known most of these people for decades, and I had never heard those stories. I knew they were there just because I knew they were there, but I had never heard the stories, not even the two that were posted by my younger brothers, right? So not only did we have this common experience of trauma, we also commonly dealt with it alone because we hadn't talked about it, because we were raised to only bring good things into our homes, right? We were raised not to bring extra problems into our homes, and certainly not to do the kinds of things that might have caused our parents to want to do something about it and therefore end up interacting with the police in ways that were dangerous. Can you talk about that trauma, the fact of that trauma specifically around Black people, all of us, those of us who are like me and comfortably a part of communities like GSV, but also those of us that we see on the streets protesting directly. Can you talk about how that trauma should inform what we're trying to think about here today?
Yeah. First of all, I'm really sorry to hear about anyone who has a gun pulled on them. I also really appreciate the folk who jumped into the comments who said, what I know you know is that Black women for days have been harassed both sexually up and down street corners and homes during domestic violence disputes. Their answers and calls for help have been ignored. And oftentimes, the real gag is that both Black men and men in general can continue to perpetuate systems of oppression and violence against Black women. And Black women are always the people who are on the front lines when it comes to fighting for this movement around police accountability, even with the common statistic of Black men are most likely to be killed by police than any other group of people. So first of all, let's give a shout out to Black women who are always in this Amen. Movement alongside this work. And speaking of Black women, I want to tell you, I want to answer that question by the way my sister, my little sister, my younger sister, who has been such an incredible inspiration to me in my life. My little sister was 28 years old, and she was diagnosed with breast cancer 2 years ago. And when I found out, I organized friends to be at her chemo session so she wouldn't be alone during those sessions. I left my job for a few weeks to visit her. I live in Oakland. I visited her in New York to help her recover from her surgery. And I paid as much of her medical bills as I could afford. She's cancer-free now, but a few months ago, she called me. And she was like, hey, I'm angry with you because you did not drop everything you had going on in your life. You did not quit your job, break your lease, and put my relationship on hold, and move to New York to be with her until she no longer needed me. And that was a super hard pill for me to swallow. And so, of course, I asked a friend for advice. And I'll never forget what they asked me. Is that reasonable? And I think about that question a lot. Like, as an abolitionist, I'm reminded of how often I'm asked this question. Is it reasonable to live in a world with no police? And when I asked my sister why she waited so long to tell me all of this, her response was that she had lived a life that required her as a Black woman to avoid taking up too much space in any room, which meant asking for what she thought others found reasonable. And so at first I blamed her for asking so much of me, but I've recently come around. I'm glad that my little sister stopped asking me for what was reasonable and started asking me for what she needed to heal. The U.S. spends $100 billion in policing, and we don't have the money to build quality, affordable housing for millions of people tonight who will go home who will not go home to a warm bed. Like Anu said, 14 million students are in schools with police, but don't got no counselor, nurse, psychologist, or social worker. One in 1,000 Black men is killed by police every year, basically making it the sixth leading cause of death for young Black men in America, right behind cancer. I don't know if defunding the police is reasonable, but I know it's what we need to heal. And we cannot continue using police to solve symptoms of poverty, crippling education system, white supremacy, and anti-Blackness. So when I think about this question regarding the way with which we show up in our trauma, I'm reminded of the way my sister felt in showing up in this space of in ensuring that she didn't take up too much of the space and say what it is that she needed. But instead she said what she thought would be reasonable for the men in her life, for the people in her life. And I feel like all of us are living under a system that is asking us to be okay with 25,000 families owning 40% of world wealth, while you have a regular person who lives homeless on your street corner. What police are asking us to do in their law enforcement, let's be clear about what laws they are enforcing, they are oftentimes, if not completely, the personal bodyguards of those 25,000 families who own 40% of global wealth, while we are still living in a world full of poverty. If we can create a world that can produce so many damn billionaires, there is no way we cannot end poverty. It's not a question of can we, it is a question of will we. And I think police reinforce the ideology that we should be okay with living in that world, that we should be okay with so few people having so much more than us. We should be okay with 14 million students going to school who have no social worker but have police. We should be okay with George Floyd dying from a police officer who was sworn to protect him and living through the deadliest virus known in modern history, right? That police let us know we should be all right with being abused by them. And so when you tell me about the stories about a police officer pulling a gun on friends of yours who are Black men, I'm reminded of the way with which police oftentimes can get the job done without ever needing to pull their gun. And that is that there lies the issue, is that the constraint exists because police exist. And even if you don't have a gun pulled on you by a police officer, doesn't mean you're not impacted, just the same way Sharonda said, by the way with which they might pull a gun on you. And you can rearrange your entire lifestyle around the living existence of an occupying force like police. And so that's why I say abolition has to end. Police has to end. And the real issue is that we continue to solve our problems with violence. And the United States government has been doing that both domestically and abroad. And it is teaching our children to respond in violence through our conflict. And if we want to teach children, ourselves, our children's children, and our children's grandchildren, it will require us to use different means of addressing our social conflict that does not include violence. And for that sake, if only for that sake, if that was the only reason you wanted to abolish police, was to teach children that addressing social conflict doesn't have to rely on a badge and a gun or other violence, both domestically and foreign, it is still a very good reason to abolish the police.
As always, you, all of you, are expanding my thinking, which is exactly what I wanted to happen to hear today. Thank you so much for doing that. On the disabolition concept, right? The dismantling of systems and structures. Let's take it back to school, okay? I'm speaking to you all today from the village of Harlem in the city of New York, where if you are both Black and poor, the chances of your ever being a college graduate is a single digit number. I've seen a lot of different single digit numbers, but I've seen, but they're all single digit numbers. So let's pretend for a moment that it's 10%. Should I think that school systems like this one in the city that I love are designed to promote the success of all of its students and fail 90% of the time, or that they are designed to reinforce class and